You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Hi, Alan.
Hi, Kester.
Hi. Sorry, this is my first time meeting you in studio.
Indeed, likewise, and Sophia as well. Yes, indeed. Mm. So, my goodness, the numbers of the presenters I've been through on this show, it's getting to ridiculous proportions. But good to have you guys, and let's talk science.
Yeah, so what have you got for us about daylight savings?
Well, let's talk about daylight saving, because it's gone in a couple of weeks, and so that means that, it's going to be getting darker sooner, which I hate. That sucks. Mm. But getting up at the moment is tough because it's pitch black out there. And so, you know, when that's gone, that means that you're going to be getting up in the light for a while anyway. So it's not that big a thing in New Zealand, this whole daylight saving thing. I know that you were saying, Kester, that you are a fan.
Yeah.
And you're
not.
And no, it's Jess that wasn't a fan. Yes, indeed. But let alone New Zealand, I mean, we're stuck in one time zone. We're a very sort of narrow country, so there's not a big difference in sort of times, let's say, across the country. You know, you've got East Cape as the easternmost point, and you've got, you know, somewhere down in Fiordland and as the westernmost point. We don't span more than one time zone. Whereas you get countries that do, like, you know, the States and Russia and stuff like that. They've been doing studies there to see whether it makes any difference whether you live basically on the east end, on the east of a time zone, or at the very west of a time zone, right next to the next door time zone, as it were. And so seemingly these people have done these studies, and they're finding out that if you live in the very, very west part of a time zone, that basically you're more susceptible to car accidents, of all things. And the reason then being that essentially what you've got is that if you're on the west of a time zone, that means that the sun's going to go down later than it would be at the east.
Right.
Okay. And the sun's going to come up later as well. Okay. So you're going to be getting up in the dark, and you're going to be going to bed maybe still while it's light. Okay. And so, in other words, you don't want to go to bed when it's light, do you?
No.
Nobody wants that. And so therefore, if you live on the west-hand side of a time zone, chances are what you're going to be doing is you're going to be going to bed later because you don't want to go to bed while it's still light, but you've still got to get up at the same time where it's going to be pitch black, you've had less sleep, you're tired, and so therefore, this is the hypothesis anyway, is that you're going to be more likely to be involved in car accidents and stuff, and this is how they explain that. So they've actually, you know, done the science, and they found that, yes, you are more susceptible to being in car accidents if you live on the west-hand side, or the, it's not west-hand side, the west of a time zone, okay? And so this is kind of the whole daylight saving thing in miniature, really, because, you know, that's essentially what we're doing. When we go into daylight saving and out of daylight saving, we're basically changing a time zone. And again, studies have shown that when you do change from daylight saving either forward or backwards, then in those few weeks around that time, that yes, there does seem to be an increase in accidents and stuff like that. And so, you know, it's the same sort of thing, and we find that this really does affect some people. Some people seem totally oblivious to it. I don't seem to mind it. I seem to be okay. I can cope with it, but it really does get to some people. And basically, you're sort of interrupting your biological rhythms, because your biological rhythms, we are basically hardwired to get up when the sun comes up and to go to bed when the sun goes down. And I guess that makes an awful lot of sense, because, you know, way back in the day when they didn't have lighting and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah, no point staying up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, what are you going to do? It's pitch black out there. So we are, to a certain extent, messing with these biological rhythms, as I say, which are hardwired. So what happens, when the clocks go forward, we're getting up before the sun comes up, sort of thing. So we're getting up when it's dark, and that's, you know, that's not what you're used to. And then basically we're going to bed before we're ready to go to bed, sort of thing, because, you know, it's still light and we shouldn't be in bed, but we think that we have to. So, I mean, there are arguments to be made for and against the whole daylight savings thing, but this seems to be big in the States at the moment, that a bill had been passed by the Senate looking at having permanent daylight saving time. Mm. So there's the argument of... I think the States, they have it for quite a long time. They have it for, I think, about 8 months of the year. Mm. And in fact, in 1973, they went to full-time daylight saving time. but then the public found out, oh, heck, I don't like getting up in the winter when it's absolutely pitch black. And yep. So they then reverted to basically 8 months on, 4 months off thing. And so there's this discussion at the moment as well. And on the side of permanent daylight saving time seems to be the politicians, surprise, surprise, and on the side against the permanent daylight saving time, so just staying at standard time the whole time, are, of course, the scientists who have come up with all sorts of reasons why, you know, we shouldn't be doing this. And this is something I never thought of, that the advocates for staying at the normal standard time have said, why don't we then maybe start schools an hour later in the winter,
I'm sure,
or start work an hour later and just go for that hour longer. And that seems to be, to me, extraordinarily sensible.
Quite nice.
Yeah. Would be difficult to do. And again, as somebody said, I mean, this whole thing with time zones and stuff like that, I mean, you know, poor old Australia, you know, they're all up the wazoo because Queensland doesn't have daylight saving.
Right,
and because apparently the argument, well, they held a referendum, I believe, on this, and the argument was that it would fade the curtains because you've got more hours in the day. this was their argument. But, I mean, the worst one is China, because China spans about five time zones and it's the same time in all the time zones. So, in other words, midday, and now, how does this work? Yeah, like when it's midday in the east, it's midday in the west and it's still dark, you know. It's crazy. I don't know how they make it work, but they do. But I just thought that, you know, this might be a germane time to sort of bring this up, given the fact that we are coming into the dark days of winter, literally. Yeah,
sure. And then, obviously, you've got this bit on handwriting for students.
Oh, yes, indeed. I'm a big believer in handwriting, and it's a dying art. And everybody always comments on my handwritten notes.
I was just going to say, they're beautiful.
Yeah,
they're not really. But I always handwrite the notes because it just helps me remember things. And I've always found that, you know, studying through university and stuff. And dare I say it, when I started, they didn't have whiteboards, they had blackboards, you know.
Yeah.
And we certainly didn't have PowerPoints and stuff like that. So, and I think that the big thing with students now is, right, all the PowerPoints are there and I just have to look at them on the screen and somehow they're going to infuse themselves into my brain, so I just don't have to, you know, do very much.
Yep.
Just look at them and it'll be there and I'll pass my exams and blah, 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 blah. And I've always said, no, it doesn't work. And the way, if you want to learn, the way to learn is to write stuff down and keep writing stuff down, make notes of your notes and then make notes of your notes of your notes and then et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Just write. And so, as I say, it's something I've always said, and now workers in Norway have thankfully done a study on this, and they've shown, yep, I'm right. Basically.
That was good.
So they were looking at the difference between handwriting and typing, and looking particularly at brain activity when you're doing both of those processes. So what happens is that they would have a word on a computer screen, and everyone would be hardwired up, so monitoring brain activity. And they would look at the difference between writing that down using a digital pen or typing it out. And they found absolutely that the brain activity was hugely increased when you were writing stuff down, physically writing stuff down, versus just typing it, okay? And what they found, so it's an increase in brain activity, but specifically it's an increase in brain activity in the areas of the brain associated with learning and memory,
right,
particularly. And so this is sort of saying that that something's going on there with respect to memory. They also found that what was happening when you were writing stuff down is that were connections being made in the brain between the outer areas of the brain, which is to do with moving and sensing, and the inner areas of the brain, which are to do with memory, the central parts, okay? So, and, you know, as I said, and I quote, on the whole, brain activity is, quote, much, much higher, unquote, for handwriting. And so, you know, the fact that that seems to be associated with the memory part of the brain, it just makes sense that if you want to remember something, then write it down and write it down again and write it down again. And, you know, I hate to sound like an old fogey, I probably am, but, you know, in this digital age and everything like that, it's just all too easy to just sit back and you've got everything presented to you on a platter. You just do. And I think way back when I was in lectures, the actual act of having to copy stuff down in lectures, because the lecturer would be writing stuff on the blackboard and you would have to be writing it down and you would have to be paying attention not only to what was being written down but what they were saying as well. So, you know, you were really, really seriously concentrating on what they were doing and what they were saying, and you were just trying to get everything down. And then chances are what you would do after the lecture, you'd go through and, you know, and rewrite it, etc., etc., etc. It just makes sense. So
yeah. And then lastly, you've got this thing about ladybugs. I gave that a little read. It was quite interesting. Strange.
Oh, very. Yes. Mm. Yes. So let's talk about the mealybug ladybird. Okay. And so these live on prickly pear cacti in Spain. Have you ever seen a prickly pear?
No. They've got nasty. It's like slightly soft and then it's quite...
But the spines on them, and they're nasty. You don't want to... No, they're nasty little things. And they're not native to Spain. So they came from the Americas originally, okay, which is important to the story. And this mealybug ladybird is also not native to Spain. It also came from Australia, of all places. Okay, so this mealybug ladybird, now it's busy, you know, chowing down on this prickly pear cactus, and then you've got a few ants coming out and think, oh, there's dinner. And so the ants come out, this ladybird then excretes this red material, okay? And this is called a hemolymph, okay? And it's full of a compound called carminic acid, and that is nasty. It's toxic and it keeps the ants away, okay? And so far so boring, really, because that's, you know, that's just one of a huge number of sort of chemical defense techniques that have that are known in nature. You know, insects, even animals and stuff like that, you know, they've got these, they utilize chemicals to protect themselves, okay? Now this is a bit different though, because the ladybug doesn't manufacture the carminic acid by itself, okay? So it gets it from somewhere else. Now, again, this is not absolutely unprecedented, because there are other things. There are toads, for example, that can eat venomous insects and stuff like that, and then utilize that venom to save themselves against attack from other things. Now, they can do that because they've co-evolved, that they have evolved, you know, in a similar part of the world, the ecosystem, call it what you will, and they're evolving together, and they've evolved to so they've got this sort of symbiotic relationship. Well, it's not too symbiotic, because the bugs get eaten, but the toads can utilize that because as a result of evolution. But the big difference here is that nothing is native to Spain in this case. The ants are, okay, but the prickly pear is not, and then your ladybug's not. And so what happens, how does the ladybug get this carminic acid? It gets it from eating cochineal bugs. Now, if you've heard of cochineal,
maybe
food coloring.
Yeah,
so red food coloring, that's what we used to use for red food coloring. You used to crush up these bugs and everything and cochineal. Now it just so happens that these cochineal bugs are full of this carminic acid
that we've been eating, or
no, they can manufacture it, okay? So when the ants come out, the ants keep away from the cochineal bugs, okay? But the ladybugs, they chew them up for breakfast, their breakfast, lunch and dinner. They're quite happy eating the cochineal bugs. Now, the cochineal bugs were, again, they came from the Americas on the prickly pear, okay? And so we've got these ladybugs that came from Australia, okay, relatively recently and everything, and now they're able to chow down on these cochineal bugs, ingest this carminic acid, and then use it for a defense mechanism for themselves. And this is the first time that this has been seen, that this is The first example where you've got no evolutionary history. They haven't evolved together. They've come from completely different parts of the planet. But somehow, these guys have now got an immunity to this carminic acid and they can utilize it themselves. So this is chemical warfare at its best, really.
It's incredible.
Very, very impressive stuff. So a nice little story to end on.
Yeah, all right. Thank you. Thank you for coming in today, Alan.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you, Mosat.
Here.
And thank you, science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Mosat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.